the headlines, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and the Armenian Prime Minister Pashinyan highlight the need for sustainable peace and security in the Caucasus region. Russia conducts one of the heaviest missile strikes against Ukraine since the start of the war after Moscow's Black Sea Fleet were targeted in a massive drone attack. And police in South Korea admit that their crowd control tactics on the night of Halloween were not enough. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. President Ebrahim Raisi reiterates Iran's stance that the dispute between Armenia and Azerbaijan in the Caucasus should be resolved by regional players. Raisi was speaking in a joint press conference with the visiting Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan after the two officials held talks on expanding bilateral ties. The Iranian president added that any foreign interference in the Caucasus will only add to the regional problems. Raisi also said peace and security in the Caucasus region are of prime significance for Iran. He also talked about bilateral relations with Armenia. Raisi said achieving the target trade of $3 billion with Armenia is possible if Tehran and Yerevan both show determination in that regard. Pashinyan also echoed Raisi on the need for sustainable peace and security in the Caucasus. Iran has imposed sanctions on a number of American individuals and entities for offenses including human rights violations and supporting terrorism. Iran's foreign ministry says they were also sanctioned for interfering in Iran's internal affairs, instigating violence and riots in the country, and committing economic terrorism against the Iranian nation. 10 individuals and 4 entities are on the blacklist. They include the commander of the U.S. Central Command, the U.S. Deputy Secretary of Treasury, the CIA, and the U.S. National Guard. Over the past few weeks, the U.S. and its allies have imposed several rounds of sanctions on Iran over what they call a crackdown on anti-government protests. Iran dismisses the allegations, saying it is dealing with foreign-backed riots. Iran says an informal meeting the U.S. plans to hold in the U.N. Security Council on the recent riots in the country sets a dangerous precedent. Iran's ambassador to the U.N. says the U.S. is not qualified legally, morally, and politically to hold such a meeting. The informal meeting is jointly proposed by the U.S. and Albania. The envoy says that the meeting would be a hypocritical and deceitful attempt to abuse human rights against Iran. Amir Said Erevani says that the U.S. seeks to exploit human rights to advance its own political objectives. Iran has been witnessing riots since last month over the death of 22-year-old woman Mahsa Amini. Moving on, Russia's President Vladimir Putin has held a trilateral summit with the leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan in the wake of tensions between the two ex-Soviet neighbors. In a joint statement after the talks, Baku and Yerevan agreed not to use force to resolve their dispute over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Our correspondent, Marina Korsunova, has the details.
Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted the leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan in an attempt to help the two ex-Soviet states settle their long-standing conflict. Putin said he's hopeful that the summit will make it possible to outline steps to resolve the Nagorno-Karabakh issue, adding the Armenian leadership has the political will to resolve the conflict with Azerbaijan. Putin, however, noted Moscow does not impose anything on anyone and only offers a peaceful solution.
I know that you have the political will for this, and we support it in every possible way. We must find the key points that will allow us to move forward. This conflict has been going on for decades, so we still need to end it sometime.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan reacted to Putin's remarks, voicing his readiness to accept Moscow's offer to establish diplomatic relations with Baku. Azerbaijan President Ilham Aliyev also said that the Karabakh conflict has already become history and it is time to talk about the normalization of relations between Yerevan and Baku. He expressed gratitude to Russia for trying to resolve the issue. Some experts believe the U.S. and some European countries, particularly France, are trying to foment discord between Armenia from Russia. Russia, reformat their friendly relations to hostility, withdraw Armenia from the CSTO and encourage Yerevan for a new large-scale military conflict with Azerbaijan.
France is actively intervening in the conflict. NATO's interests are visible behind it. The USA has one of its largest embassies in Yerevan, the same with Azerbaijan. There goes Israel and the UK. The latter is one of Turkey's closest friends. Another bloc of countries is being formed there, but they all work in the same direction. They are opposed to the participation of Iran and Russia in resolving this conflict and are trying to replace the participation of neighboring states with that of Western ones. This deprives the people of Armenia and Azerbaijan of a peaceful solution.
A six-week war between Azerbaijan and Armenia in 2020, which claimed the lives of more than 6,500 troops on both sides, ended with a Russian brokered deal that saw Yerevan cede swathes of territory that it had controlled for several decades. Last month, 286 people from both sides were killed in the flare-up of new clashes.
Moscow's task is to find ground for a compromise. The interference of Turkey, France, Britain and the United States in the Armenian-Azerbaijani relations in recent months, the so-called Western Peace Project may simply threaten the disappearance of Nagorno-Karabakh. Most experts believe the mediation of such countries is a trap from which there is no way out. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The Ukrainian army says Russia has hit the country with a volley of 55 cruise missiles as well as other ammunition. The army says the Monday attack hit civilian targets. Ukraine's presidential advisor has described the strike as one of the largest since the war began in February. Officials say that the strikes left hundreds of areas across Ukraine without power. Russia's President Vladimir Putin says the attack was a partial response to drone strikes on the country's Black Sea Fleet. Putin says Russia could have done more. Putin has blamed Ukraine for the attacks that prompted Moscow to suspend a deal to allow Ukrainian grain exports despite the war. Tensions are growing between the EU and the U.S. over trade-related matters. Brussels claims measures introduced by Washington to fight inflation will damage EU firms. There's also growing disquiet over the price America is charging the EU for its gas. Durham Hughes reports.
Importing liquefied natural gas from the US is costing the EU a fortune, and leaders across the 27-nation bloc are looking for a better deal. EU trade ministers met on Monday. They are also not happy with Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. It includes state aid for American manufacturers that will put EU car builders at a disadvantage.
I will be pretty frank. I think in the form how it was presented, I think for the European Union is unacceptable.
This is all happening due to Western sanctions against Russia. Inflation is out of control. We've asked the European Commission why it's not trying to broker peace between Russia and Ukraine.
It just seems to be not on the agenda at all. Am I completely off the mark in that regard?
We have always said that whoever can use its influence to stop the war in Russia and to make to stop the war in Ukraine, we will support this.
EU trade ministers accuse Russia of using food as a weapon after Moscow left a UN-negotiated deal to facilitate grain shipments from Ukraine. It follows drone attacks on Russia's Black Sea Fleet near Sevastopol on Saturday. The Kremlin blames Kiev, helped by British experts. Eurozone inflation has climbed to a new record high of 10.7%. EU leaders are being urged to tackle a growing social crisis in the bloc.
It is in the hand of the decision makers because it is very easy to solve this problem. And it is a shame for the European Union and for the member states.
Many claim the West could have prevented the war in Ukraine by listening to Russia's security concerns surrounding the issue of NATO expansion. Massive public protests are forecast as wages in the EU fail to keep up with soaring inflation. Already here in Belgium, police have agreed to hold a one-day strike on the 9th of November. The country's firefighters have announced they will do the same in December. A date for that has yet to be announced. It's set to be a winter of discontent for EU governments. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Germany and France are alarmed over the new trade laws in the U.S. that make investment in the country overly competitive. Washington's new tax cuts and energy benefits for companies investing there have prompted strong reactions from the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and the French President Emmanuel Macron.
The German Chancellor and the French President met in Paris to recalibrate their relations, as there seems to be a rise in tensions over issues related to energy, economy, and defense between Europe's two biggest economies. Germany and France are the driving forces behind many of the key decisions made by the European Union, such as a plan to raise billions of euros in debt to cushion the blow of the pandemic.
We are the biggest supporter of Europe. We are paying 26% of the budget, usually, and we are developing a lot of solidarity mechanisms, as we did in the last crisis, looking at Corona, with the instruments we developed with the RRF and the recovery fund is a good chance for acting together also in the time we have now.
But amongst the differences in their policies that have become cause for fallouts, Scholz and Macron seem to be on the same page when it comes to seeing European investments being hijacked by the US as a result of new policies in Washington. Macron believes that as businesses are given incentive to, quote, buy American, France will lose 8 billion euros. What Macron is referring to exactly is the biggest climate and energy package in US history, recently signed by Joe Biden. The Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, or the IRA, includes $600 billion in spending in total, with $370 billion dedicated to supporting renewable energy and climate resilience. Washington is hoping to find the budgets for the package by sorting out large corporations' long-running tax evasions, as well as those of the top 1%, whether or not the corporations and the elite will still be able to evade taxes, as they've been doing for so long, remains to be seen, though. One of the measures in the IRA includes tax rebates for buyers of American-made electric vehicles, among many other industry credits for clean energy initiatives. These incentives will move operations from France to the US to take advantage of these subsidies, according to Macron. He's even called the IRA measures unfairly protectionist. There is agreement among the EU bloc members that tangible and concrete measures need to be taken. Among the potential responses that the EU could give to the IRA policy is filing a complaint to the World Trade Organization that would call for adding European-made products to become a part of the US rebate plan.
The EU is convinced that it cannot sit idly by while the new American policies can very well make manufacturing an investment into the US. The bloc is poised to hit back with its own incentive schemes, but if things spiral out of control, a potential transatlantic trade war might be on the horizon.
In an interview with France 2 TV channel, Emmanuel Macron proposed his response to the US measure. We need a Buy European Act like the Americans. We need to reserve our subsidies for our European manufacturers. Macron even referred to similar policies in China, saying, you have China that is protecting its industry, the US that is protecting its industry, and Europe that is an open house. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, while not a big fan of the bi-European rhetoric, shares Macron's concerns over the unfair US competition. He is especially hurt when he found out that German chemical giant BASF is planning to cut down its business activities in Germany, as the company's chief says the gas prices in Germany are 6 times higher than in the US, and increasing EU regulations aren't helping his business either. German Finance Minister Christian Lindner has acknowledged that and responded by saying, the decision of a successful company like BASF showed that we need to improve the overall attractiveness of Germany as a business location. He also said Germany needs to pursue tax relief for private investors. Now Scholz and Macron are trying to reach an agreement with Washington to sort out their differences through a newly formed US-EU task force on the Inflation Reduction Act.
Whoa! Ladies and gentlemen, after years and years of hard work, it's official. Micron is coming to central New York.
It remains to be seen whether the deindustrialization that is plaguing Europe, mainly as a result of the energy crunch that is causing the exodus of European countries from the bloc, but now also because of Washington's incentives for investors in the US, can be fixed through reaching a compromise with the US. Because the alternative would be either a transatlantic trade war or an even bigger economic slump for a Europe unattractive to companies and investors, new and old.
South Korea promises a speedy inquiry into the recent Halloween crush in the capital, Seoul, in an attempt to calm public anger over the deadly incident. In a parliamentary address, the Interior Minister Lee Sang-min has apologized to the public and pledged to make sure such disasters do not happen again. He has faced fierce criticism for stating that deployment of more police would not have prevented the tragedy. The police chief has also acknowledged police missteps that contributed to the incident.
We found out that there were lots of 112 calls before the accident about the seriousness of the place. The calls were about the emergencies telling the danger and urgency of the situation that large crowds had gathered before the accident occurred. However, we think the police response to the 112 calls was inadequate.
They've also said that they had no guidelines to handle the expectedly large crowd. South Korea is observing a 7-day mourning period over the tragedy. The stampede took place as South Koreans marked their first mask-free Halloween in 3 years. People were crushed after those at the top of a sloped alley fell over the others. The incident has so far killed 156 people. The dead are from South Korea and 14 other countries. Scores of others are also injured, 30 in critical condition. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the social and political crisis in France. But first, this brief analysis.
France has been experiencing social and political crises of various forms for at least the last 10 years. But one would be hard-pressed to know this from watching Western mainstream media. Only when the French state began to brutally suppress the continuously held yellow vest protests, including the deployment of the French military to the streets of all major cities, and the use of munitions, resulting in the loss of eyes and limbs among protesters, did many realize the gravity of the situation. EU-mandated austerity policies imposed by the two traditional political parties in their respective administrations, following France's cult-like commitment to European integration embodied in the Lisbon Treaty of 2009, resulted in the collapse of the two-party dominant system of socialists and Gaullists, which had existed in France since the 1960s, a system which created a reasonable level of political representation for the poor and working class in the French state. The far-right nationalist currents and parties gained many disgruntled voters from both sides, and out of this mess emerges a wondrous media gestalt with minimum qualifications, called Emmanuel Macron, supported and sponsored by the French billionaire elite, to be crowned the youngest president in French history. Macron was made leader of a new neoliberal political organization that continues where the two older parties failed the EU to forcefully implement all the EU-mandated austerity measures. When confronted by opposition in the French parliament, the young president rules by the significant decree powers that the constitution of the Fifth French Republic grants the president, in this process, dismantling the French social welfare state, which had been the basis of social stability in France since World War II. There is an ominous contradiction between the positive image of France that's portrayed in the billionaire-owned media and the negative reality on the ground among the average population. A reality which occasionally rips through the fake media imagery when Macron is slapped, booed, or pelted with rotten fruits when he's forced to step out among the rabble during election seasons. There doesn't seem to be a political party or movement currently in France who's offering solutions to the basic historic and structural problems that France is facing. Media propaganda, rule by decree, and when necessary, sending the military into the streets are the methods of rule that the French elite and oligarchy have chosen in the last years in order to forcefully end the French social welfare state, contrary to the wishes of the overwhelming majority of French citizens. The Fifth French Republic is itself the result of the social, political, and economic upheaval that France experienced in the 1960s following the loss of its empire and the devastating Algerian War of Independence. It remains to be seen if the Fifth Republic will end in social turmoil and upheaval just as it began.
Author and journalist Ramin Mazahedi, thank you for joining us on Insight. We want to have a nice conversation about France and what's going on in France. You've been there for many years now as the Press TV journalist. You've also recently written a book about the Yellow Vest movement, which was a social movement there in France, which I was hoping that you could maybe also talk about that a little bit and all the events that are happening in France. Let me begin our conversation maybe with this introduction. We see that France is basically going through a very long period of turmoil, of political instability, which, you know, obviously, when you have this kind of political instability, it's probably rooted in some sort of a social and economic instability. We see that the two main political orientations of parties, the Gaullists, the Socialists, which were dominant in the Fifth French Republic, and we can also talk about the historically the different republics that have existed. We see that, you know, since at least 2017, with the coming of Emmanuel Macron, that these kind of political parties and movements, the traditional ones, have also kind of changed. There's new movements. There's the kind of so-called centrist movement that Emmanuel Macron, who was at one point part of the Socialist Party, entered the politics with that movement. We see the rise or the reinvigoration of the nationalist movement under Marine Le Pen, who is the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen. So there's a lot of things going on in France. And as somebody who spent a lot of time there and who studied it deeply, we would want you to, in this program, maybe give us some of your own insight into what's going on in France. So what's going on in France?
Well, like you said, I mean, I've been there for 13 years, and I have a certain point of view that's unique to the daily hard news reporter. I think this is what our listeners can kind of benefit from. It's great to have academics. It's great to have think tanks. It's great to have different types. So the daily hard news is sort of it's a different perspective because every day you're looking at the news and you have to make a decision that day. You have to make a judgment on, was this policy good? Is this policy working? This bill, is it working? Did this politician deliver on what he just said?
Right.
And, to go back to your main point, I can tell you from on the ground reporting, you know, you were talking about the two mainstream parties in France. They are totally smashed. They are totally discredited with the average person. Mm-hmm. It's over. It's right. Finished for the Socialist Party. It's finished for the Gaullist Party in whatever form want to call them. Sarkozy, Macron. Macron, as a centrist, that is smashed as well. Right. He was never a centrist. He was always a right-wing politician. Mm-hmm. He was a Gaullist minus the love for France, minus the patriotism. And that's basically what the two mainstream parties have become. They are no longer pro-France parties. They are pro-EU parties. Mm-hmm. This is something that I think many people don't understand, and many people don't understand in France, and even the Yellow Vests don't understand. And that's this concept that since 2009, since the forced installation of the Lisbon Treaty, mm-hmm. which became a part of the very foundation foundational texts of the EU, of the pan-European project, Europe has drastically changed. Mm-hmm. We are talking about very, very different things. It's a brand new era across Europe in France. And what that means, and even the Yellow Vests, who are so politically intelligent, they don't understand this. France, this guy right here, Macron, does not have control over his currency, over France's budget, over France's skies, over France's rails. So many things. Right. It's a brand new Europe, and the Yellow Vests provide a sort of capstone to the end of the era of European social democracy. The EU is the assassin of social democratic measures. The idea that, well, we don't want socialist central planning, we don't want socialist total equality, but we do want social security, we do want some, unemployment insurance. This era, it was called in France the 30 glorious years from 1945 to 1975. Mm-hmm. That is what in Europe, what neoliberalism is trying to end. That's what the EU is there for. And what I can, to just go back to what I was saying about how being a daily hard news journalist on the ground, the benefit it has is I can report the Yellow Vests were only 15-20% worse in terms of how they were repressed than in 2016, 2014, 2010. There has just been, since 2009, as my book shows, as it relates, the pan-European project has totally failed to bring prosperity, democracy, and stability. And the Yellow Vests are the outgrowth of that. And we can focus on Macron, but Francois Hollande, his predecessor, was just as bad. Sarkozy was just as bad.
Because we have to remind our viewers, he was the industry minister. Emmanuel Macron was the industry minister Hollande, and Hollande was a socialist.
Right.
And we see all across Europe this idea that these socialist parties, who traditionally were supportive of the working class, we don't want to exaggerate, but as you said,
social democrats,
particularly after World War II, in most European countries, the working class, those who are, you know, workers or lower level employees, there was a level of political representation that they had within the political system of Europe.
Limited, but there.
But there was there. And yeah. and the basic standard of living was they were capable of maintaining that basic standard of living, and maybe even a little bit higher than that in terms of education, in terms of social mobility, all those things that are considered, you know, positive things.
Leading among the world, yeah, you know, but in all the European social safety net.
All that has gone now in Europe.
It's all gone. It's all gone.
In all countries that you look around Europe, those socialist parties basically became neoliberal parties in the 90s.
Right.
Whether it was in Austria, whether it was in Germany, whether it was in Britain with Tony Blair. And
that's
and
when it became totally confirmed. In France, it was with François Mitterrand's U-turn, his infamous U-turn, elected in 81 on the most leftist program in West European history.
Exactly.
83 U-turn. And it's the way that, and my book talks about this, the way that French elites have been captured by neoliberalism, but the average person has not.
Exactly.
And that's unlike in the U.S., in the U.K., the average French person is committed to ideals of egalitarianism, you know, certain reductions on individualism, and they protested in mass numbers in 95, you know, all, and then everybody in Europe starting in 2009, every spring was an anti-austerity protest.
Exactly.
So the rest of Europe kind of, you know, caught up with France, but we see with the Yellow Vests how the French are always taking it further. They are so politically enlightened, and we are going back to 1789. You know, I'm not trying to, you know, put them on a higher level, but you look at 1789 and the way that it fought against monarchy, autocracy, oligarchy, aristocracy, and then liberalism, the way that liberalism has failed in two centuries of French history, and we see it now with the European Union, the way that Western liberal democracy has failed to bring what they were asking for in 1789, egalitarianism, equality, fraternity. These, just as monarchy has failed, so Western liberalism has failed. Mm-hmm. And the Yellow Vests, they just, God bless them, they don't really understand this. The idea that the Pan-European project has failed. So they had a list of 42 different demands that
Yellow Vests.
The Yellow Vests. Not one of them mentioned Europe. Not one of them.
Right. So let me see if I understood you correctly. So we have a couple things that are happening at the same time. We have this giving away of national sovereignty under the title of European integration.
Yes.
So basically every country we see now after this process happened in the late 90s in many other countries, and then, as you mentioned, culminated in the Lisbon Treaty.
Precisely.
We have most countries regretting that, most of the population of many of the countries, not the elites, regretting that they gave away that sovereignty in the name of European integration. Now, we have to go back and also mention that at that time, when the issue of European integration was happening, the main argument was, well, we have a history of war in Europe, so let's give that nationalist sovereignty, let's give away some of that, and we will have this peaceful, you know, lovely Europe where it's all one and we're all together.
Yeah.
But it ended up ended up happening is you had basically the tools being taken away from national governments to make social and economic policy that is relevant.
Precisely.
So
we are relying on Brussels to be social democratic,
which they're obviously not going to do.
They're obviously not.
So we have this one movement. I'm trying to just summarize what I heard from what you were saying. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, we have this idea that those traditional left-wing socialist, social democratic parties, which were supposed to represent the interests of normal working class people, they had that neoliberal turn, as you said. Mm-hmm. You mentioned France. We could also mention Austria in the 80s. The Social Democratic Party being run by a banker. We could talk about then later on Gerhard Schröder in Germany with the Hartz and the Hartz IV, the program to cut Social Security. We could talk about Tony Blair, of course. So we have all this.
All over the West, like what you're saying.
Right.
I mean, we can go through every country and point out all over the West, which was never a revolutionary culture, almost never. I mean, France was 1789, but they didn't succeed. You know, it's not a place like Iran. It's not a place like China. It's not a place like Cuba. It's not like Eastern Europe.
Right.
Western Europe and the Anglophone countries, it never took hold. Elitism has dominated. liberalism, which is basically just aristocracy, rights for those who can afford it. Yeah, I mean, you know.
What I was going to say is that then what ends up happening is a lot of these working class, they start voting for right-wing nationalist parties.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have a situation, because we talked about the idea that in France we have a kind of a withering away of those two main orientations, the Gaullists,
which, totally discredited.
You know, the so-called mainstream conservatives,
totally.
and the mainstream socialists. You suddenly see a huge rise in the nationalist parties in France, in different countries. So if you could talk about that a little bit, too. The idea that you have this working class feeling, I'm not talking about all of them, mm-hmm. but the idea that you have significant portions of the working class who used to vote for socialist parties suddenly now voting for nationalist parties, with the idea of immigration and migration and all those, hot topic issues being raised for being exploited in terms of electoral power.
Who's making this a hot topic? I mean, in France, in between the presidential election of this year and the legislative election, the biggest news was the burkini, a long bodysuit so Muslim women can go to the beach. Nobody cares about the burkini.
Right.
But the 1%, the oligarchy, the people who control French media, you know, it's about 6 billionaires control something like 80%
right.
of all their media. It's this nonsense. It's this right-wing liberalist nonsense that you see all over the West, where this is what the Yellow Vest fought against. The Yellow Vest, one of their absolutely primary achievements was to put the issues of the working poor back on the agenda.
Right.
You know, people who make too much money to get, you know, any of the West's small social safety net, but they don't make enough that they can lead a stable life.
Right.
The working poor, liberalism from 1789, all throughout history, since then, with the exception of what the French call the 30 glorious years, right. 1945 to 75, the era of social democracy, Western liberalism does not care about the working poor, even though they are obviously the democratic majority. So, and this leads to, you know, what you were saying is, well, just as you said how the left abandoned the working poor in the 80s and 90s, the left doesn't, what the West calls left is no longer left.
Right.
It's about these woke issues. It's got nothing to do with the working poor. It's got nothing to do with economics. It's the same thing with the right. Is saying that the French government should be looking out for the needs of the French people, sovereignty, is that right wing? No, the West is in such a total state of disarray that leftism, which is there's a clear economic political spectrum. There's a clear left, there's a clear right, but the West doesn't know what it is.
Right.
They can't call a spade, they don't know what leftism is, and they don't know what right wing is. And this goes back to, and I talk about this in my book, this goes back in sort of, you know, more modern terms. I mean, I don't want to get back into the Second Republic when liberalism, when France was the only country that were their revolution in 1848, the revolutions of 1848, it's the counter-revolutions of 1848.
Right.
They won, but only in France, and France installed liberalism, and within 3 or 4 years, they were totally discredited. The Second Republic was pushed out. Because they saw right away, and Marx, you know, detailed this in his history, that liberalism is terrible. You know, it's just an aristocratic oligarchy. They knew
right.
this back in 1848, and they knew it starting in the 20th century. And what happened is you had fascists
mm-hmm.
use the historical analysis of Marxism to say that liberalism is awful. Liberalism is oligarchy. Liberalism is imperialism. You know, the French Third Republic that was when they were at the height of their colonial empire.
Right, correct.
The 20th century fascists, they used the tools of Marxist-inspired historicity, you know, and to, you know...
Yes.
They combined it with, you know, with racism, and they, you know, they
right.
they manipulated it. However, this is what the West modern liberalism still does. They still say Muslims, we need to invade them, we need to bomb them, and they need to, you know, stop trying to put Islam into politics. China, we need to invade them. Latin America, we need to still keep controlling them. What I'm saying is that liberalism subsumed fascism. Okay,
right.
Liberalism itself has fascist components, just as they worked with actual fascists after World War II.
Correct.
Yeah, we all know about it. This is why they're working with the neo-Nazis and fascists in Ukraine.
Exactly.
Because liberalism has subsumed fascism exactly in the way that it has subsumed monarchy. We Iranians, we know that monarchy is an evil. Autocracy is an evil.
Correct.
A quarter of the states of Europe still have monarchies. And the West doesn't realize how negative it is to how liberalism is so autocratic. And we see it right here. This guy right here, he has become the poster boy of autocracy. How did he do this? He sidelined parliament by ruling by executive decree so often.
Right.
That it just inflamed the people.
So, last thing,
Hollande used the executive.
Right. I just want to explain for our audiences. So what you're saying is that there's this facade of democracy and liberalism, where you have divided government, you have a president, you have a legislature. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that that's not actually what happens in practice.
Precisely.
We have the Fifth Republic, coming out of the turmoil of the 60s. Mm-hmm. After losing Algeria and all the events that happened. So some people have actually talked about this era of France being the post-Algerian era of France.
It's a good way to put it.
Exactly, yeah. Which then results in this turmoil in France, and then Charles de Gaulle comes in as a savior and creates this kind of imperial presidency. Mm. The idea that the Fourth Republic failed because the president wasn't strong enough, wasn't imperial enough.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could explain a little bit in terms of what you were talking about, the idea that Hollande and then now Macron even more is basically ruling by decree, whether it came to the labor laws, the reform of the labor laws, whether it came to the terrorism laws after the terrorism events and all those things. I remember you did a lot of good reports about that.
Thank you.
And so on. So if you could explain the idea that all these measures that are completely unpopular, do not have popular support, being pushed through and forced upon France by the decree of somebody we don't even know who his donors are. We still
undemocratically.
Don't.
Undemocratically. Pushed through undemocratically.
If you could give a little bit more detail about it.
And then this guy is trying to tell countries like Iran or China or, Venezuela, you know, what democracy is. What you're talking about, the French imperial, imperial executive, imperial presidency. Yes, that's the way that their system was set up. France, their executive branch has had more power than almost all of their Western counterparts for the reasons you were saying. And so there is this idea that if you are in France, and you're the boss, you should have more power. However, it's really important to kind of realize that once the Lisbon Treaty started and, Macron, the French president, no longer had control over his currency, over his budget, over his laws. The imperial presidency is in the past now. It's a historical footnote. Who the French president is now is more equivalent to a provincial governor, and he is beholden to Brussels, not to the French voter. And we see this all over the EU. We saw this with
in Greece. Ramin, let me just, I want to understand this correctly. Mm. So we have this idea that in the late, in the 90s and in the early 21st century, there is this idea that there has to be a neoliberal order. That system of having a welfare state that was created some sort of a level of social stability in European countries is no longer capable of why? Because all the resources are not going to the elites. Mm-hmm. So what you have is the EU imposing these rules and these regulations, and then in every country you have the local governments being the enforcers of that.
Correct? And this is why you have voter participation plummeting in France, for the legislative elections here. They were the lowest not only in the Fifth Republic, but the Third Republic, the Second Republic, because they know that people in Europe, this is what I can report being there for, 13 years on the ground, they are realizing that their votes don't matter. That if they vote in a way that the oligarchy, Brussels, the 1%, the neo-aristocracy, any way you want to put it, if the people vote against that, Brussels will strike it down, or they will just legislate around it, or they will just ignore it. We saw it most famously with Greece in...
Exactly.
And but people think, well, France is not Greece. France is, you know, eight times the size. France is mighty France. You know, Greece's heyday was, you know, 2,500 years ago.
Right.
No, France is just like Greece. They are, the French people are as powerless as the,
right.
you know, Greek people. And this is something that...
So let me...
People are getting... But right. you might find this interesting.
Right.
Because you were talking about how the EU is the result of peace. Part of being PC in Europe is to not criticize the EU right. project because you're being then assaulted as, you know, a modern fascist.
Right.
Which is going back to what right. we're saying, how the definitions of left and right are immutable, historical.
Ramin Mazari, thank you so much for our conversation. Until the next time on Insight.
Thank you.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Ramin Mazari? France is experiencing a deep social and political crisis. Following the Lisbon Treaty and in the context of European integration, a loss of national sovereignty has occurred in which the power of the national government is limited to the imposition of austerity measures in order to remain in good standing with the EU and the global financial and banking system. Like in most other European countries, political parties and currents in France have lost credibility with the voters, as the traditional left-wing and right-wing parties abandoned their core beliefs and supporters and morphed into cynical neoliberal elite parties, virtually indistinguishable from one another. Traditional working-class voters increasingly voted for nationalist parties and currents, but as the last presidential elections in France showed, even these parties are dropping some of their core beliefs like Euroscepticism and adopting positions to attract voters in order to maintain whatever power they have gained in the preceding years. The presidency of Emmanuel Macron has become the symbol of this artificially imposed neoliberal order on a population which consistently rejects most of the austerity agenda being imposed, regularly protests this state of affairs in the streets, and continues to vote for anti-establishment parties. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked as
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned. We humans are all the servants of Allah. Being servant here means that we humans are the creatures of Allah, and at every moment we are learning from Allah. As Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, I am the servant of the best servant of Allah, Prophet Muhammad. Therefore, Allah is both our creator and our master, and we must obey him. Now, our duty is to respect our master and our teachers. The least effect of being in servitude to Allah is to be only His servant and not be the servant of others. In other words, if we obey Allah, we are in no need to obey others. As Hafez stated, a true spiritual wayfarer who knows the right path, he will never knock the door of others except Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com
www.islamic.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.